that caste has never been abolished, and that India itself was violently put together, including occupying Kashmir, and lets the perception settle that India was an exceptional state with a moral backbone that held it back from becoming closer to Israel. But New Delhi, like other states, designed its foreign policy based on self-interest. There was a certain currency with the so-called Third World to be seen as pro-Palestine. It didn't have the military to compete with the world powers, so it instead became a critic of it. It bided its time. Nehru and Co. allowed an incomplete narrative of Indian descent and objection to the Zionist project to grow and to thrive. It inadvertently helped bury the question of the Indian caste system in the West and elsewhere. In other words, and as you would know for decades, India has been largely and uncritically so seen as a left-leaning anti-colonial state that held Palestine as its moral center, despite its occupation of Kashmir and its violent policies towards Muslims and Dalits and Adivasis. These issues, many liberals and leftists say, only propped up recently with the rise of Hindu nationalism. But India bought weapons from Israel as early as 1962 in its war against China, under Nehru. Again in 65 and in 71 against Pakistan, it imported weapons from Israel. And as Indira Gandhi publicly endorsed the PLO and signed on to Resolution 3379 at the UN that called Zionism racism, her office was privately facilitating Mossad and raw ties. And this continues through the 80s, when the prospect of Israeli ties is increasingly tied with modernization, development, and being closer to the US. India's charge towards neoliberalism is inextricably linked with the great charge towards Hindu nationalism. This encompasses a focus on Hindu entrepreneurship and innovation and self-reliance at the cost of Muslims and as part of a politics of reinforcing a Hindu history on the story of India. And that takes off here. Here it is India's Prime Minister, Rajiv Gandhi, who is explicitly told by American or Zionist American groups that if India wants to be close to the US, it has to reshape its policy towards Israel.
You're listening to Azad Issa, the India-Israel Alliance. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
In other words, the entanglements of Hindu nationalism and its delusions of grandeur and illusions of being a besieged people that we are seeing today in the expressions of both the support of Israel and the duplication of Zionist lies, barely fathomable deception is both the project of the so-called left and the right in India, and that extends decades. Today is no aberration. This is no coincidence. This is India. And to borrow from Edward Said's analogy about Israel and Zionism, this is India despite Hindu nationalism's impulse to conceal it. So where does it leave us? Where do we go from here? If the India-Israel alliance is not stopped, we are looking at India becoming the factory of Israeli weapons on the planet. This is to say, the mass producer of Israeli weapons. Via its hold on generational long levers of soft power, Delhi will disguise its illicit weapon sales under the rubric of defending democracy, religion, and civilization. But it will be expanding Israel's market to sell its methods and tactics. Israeli weapons are likely to emerge in more developing economies than ever before via New Delhi. And these will lean towards pacifying and controlling undesirable populations and nullifying democratic movements. Then there's the question of education, skills, and the labor pool. As American universities are struggling to justify their entanglements with Israel, so much so that this entanglement, even if remote, is actually a future possibility, Indian universities are helping build the next generation to help the settler state survive. This will influence how Asia is taught at American universities. It will seep into language. Criticizing India will become Hindophobia. It already has. We have to think about how Indian transnational and Hindutva organizing will see this moment, and as they often do, look to exacerbate restrictions on what is possible when talking about India or South Asia. Then there's a question of land and resources. The Indian government, too, is facilitating the takeover by oligarchic entities. Kashmir is just one place. The Adani group already owns 70% of the Haifa port. In other words, an Indian oligarchy owns Palestinian land. India, in conjunction with Israel and the US, have been creating an ecosystem in which these countries invest in each other to such an extent that they become, if not sort of indistinguishable from each other, they are impossible to dislodge as oppressive systems. India is therefore invested in the occupation of Palestinians. Israel has become invested in the occupation of Kashmiris and the subjugation of Indian Muslims, and likewise. Likewise, the UAE, the US, are deeply entangled in all of this too. How did the world look to dislodge apartheid in South Africa? It looked to isolate it. But how do you isolate an ecosystem that encompasses capital, military prowess, labor, soft power, hard power, and a market? This might sound incredibly distressing and heartbreaking, and it should be. We are facing dark times. But this shouldn't halt our ability to push for imaginative ways to lift the boots off our necks. None of what I have described are original or unique problems. Oppressors find the sadism they yearn for in each other, while the occupied find comfort in each other's resilience and solidarity. What the genocide in Gaza did was blow the lid of all the hypocrisies of the global world order. It showed kings to be Western puppets. It showed up the wealthy as wielding little more than affluence. It showed the Western press, Western cinema, tech behemoths to be stenographers and beholden to state propaganda. It also blew the lid off India's growing authoritarianism. Whereas it would have been very tough for South Asian scholars and activists like Professor Sharma to speak about India in an academy that has largely valorized India, the road has been cleared now to speak and examine the Indian state. The lack of ambiguity saves a lot of explanation too. This moment has seen other developments. 100 years since Malcolm X, we have seen other, or one of his dreams come to fruition. As Michael E. Sawyer said last month, South Africa's effort to take Israel to ICJ is Malcolm's dream of a colonial entity being dragged to an international institution manifest. Now, of course, we're only at the beginning of this fight, and what's left is us to decide to what extent we want to join it and how. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Azad, for this. My name is Ramana. I teach in the University of British Columbia here. I want to go back to another aspect of your biography, which is you're from South Africa. And I'm curious about two things. I mean, we know what South Africa has been doing on Israel-Palestine, and its role has been commendable. What is its view on what's happening in Kashmir and on the recent war between India and Pakistan and on the longer history? If you're thinking about what spaces we can intervene in and how we might be able to move something, one of the areas where I think there's a little bit of a schism within India is in the area of foreign policy, right? The foreign policy establishment of India does not want to completely align with the United States, right? On Israel, they'd be very happy to be aligned with it, but they don't want to be in general seen as completely in alignment. And we see that, for example, when it came to the war on Ukraine, they refused to sort of sanction Russia and things like that. And India is also, and India and South Africa, are founding members of the BRICS, right? And so that's another forum where presumably there is going to be some kind of tension between a more non-aligned version of foreign policy and one that's much more in alignment with the United States and therefore with Israel and so on. So I'm just curious what you think about if there's any tension there which we might be able to exploit.
South Africa is doing a good thing by pushing this case at the ICJ. But it's low-key complicit in the genocide itself because it's sending coal to Israel. Colombia cut the coal sort of export to Israel, but South Africa hasn't. And I suspect they would like to, but the U.S. will turn us into North Korea overnight, basically. And I think that's the issue. But it's a hypocrisy nonetheless. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that South Africa has very strong ties with India, and I think they're unsure how to go forward with that. Okay, if we go back to 1946, just before India becomes a country, and the UN was actually formed at the time, one of the first issues that were raised at the UN was South Africa's racism, and it was India who brought it up, basically. Now, it was all, this is an incomplete story as well, because India, there's always half stories with India, is that it actually raised the issue of Indian people's rights in South Africa, not black people's rights. That only happened like 12 years later or something. Anyway, but that's a half story, but still, like, that starts, you know, starts the dialogue about this apartheid state to be, because it's signed 46. Apartheid hasn't even started. Apartheid starts in 48. Now, what I mean by this is that the ANC creates very close ties as a result of that with the National Congress government, right? So these things, you know, you can't dislodge them that easily. And so there's obviously a kind of suspending of, you know, a belief regarding India, right? It's obviously they're going to sidestep India's excesses, right? I think the core of the foreign policy department in South Africa are aware of the issues in Kashmir, and I think they may be concerned about it, right? But when Pahalgam happened, for example, they put out a standard kind of condemnation. So that's just like the standard kind of discussion around, you know, the rubric of terrorism. The funny thing is that when I went to find the statement, it was taken off the website, basically. So I'm a little bit confused by that. But I feel as if there's some kind of tension that's developing regarding these things. But Kashmir is not important to South Africa, like Palestine is, right? That we've got to be clear about it. Now, I know I'm giving a bit of an unruly answer here, but the BRICS situation is also fascinating, because when it was envisaged, like more than a decade or so ago, you know, it was sort of spoken of as kind of like a response to the West in a way, right? And it'll be economic and political. But it's kind of another club of crazy characters also, right? You have Russia there, and you have China, you have, I mean, everybody else is also there now. I forget, it's like it's expanded now, right? And so one of the things about BRICS is that they've made it very clear that they don't interfere with each other's political dramas. And that has to be explored. What do they mean by that, right? And so, and India has pushed back regarding BRICS' sort of position on Gaza, right? They have pushed back against it, like subtly so. Modi didn't go to the main meeting on BRICS regarding Gaza. He skipped it, right? And so there is a tension that exists there. I think BRICS needs to be seen as a body that just wants to be their own type of gangster on the planet, basically, their response. And India, as you say, like correctly so, India doesn't want to put all its eggs with the US, but at the moment it seems to be doing a lot of that, because even with regards to BRICS, it said recently that it doesn't see BRICS as a kind of counter to the West, right? So there's a lot of changes that are taking place, and that's why I'm not so optimistic about BRICS as well.
I have two questions. One is about the role of international media like Al Jazeera. You see a lot of images of Palestinians being killed or bombed. How does India get exposed to these images? I mean, the general population. Is Al Jazeera and other international agencies exposed by the Indian people?
On the media front, they are the Indian media is extremely sensitive to the Western press. So if you write for Washington Post or you write for the New York Times, for instance, they are reading those very closely. The smaller media, they're not that interested in, right? But they are sensitive to the big media, and they spend a lot of money to lobby and also to kind of interfere to interject in that space. After 2019, they did not allow international media to travel to Kashmir for several years. I think it may have just opened a little bit now because of Pahalgam, but I'm not entirely sure. So there is a lot of effort that's made into controlling the media, international media, and a lot of sensitivity towards it. But the international English-speaking media, the mainstream one, has obviously spent more time worried about China. So because, you know, China is seen as that threat, so India kind of falls under the radar to some extent, you know, especially like the New York Times won't cover India very closely in this regard, because it kind of mirrors U.S. foreign policy. With Narendra Modi, there has been some coverage, regarding like Hindutva, Hindu nationalism. That stuff does get covered to some extent, but not anything that kind of contradicts like Western interests, basically.
My question is on practice and hope, especially hope in the youth, Indian youth. We have seen youth movements around the world, like in Africa, in USA, and we have Jewish youth, like they've joined with Jewish Voices for Peace, not in our name. Do you have similar Indian youth movements against fascism in their own country?
Yeah, there are a lot of student groups that I often speak to in different parts, whether in Hyderabad, where they're in Kerala, even New Delhi. They don't label themselves as sort of anti-fascism. They're just sort of like student groups that are mobilizing, trying to explain, trying to teach, trying to push back against things that are happening on their campuses. At this point in time, if anyone organizes on campus for Palestine, that's actually organizing against Hindutva as well, you know? It's sort of like Kashmiris, right? There was a stage where you couldn't put up any graffiti on the walls against India, right? But you put up Palestine graffiti on the walls, and you're basically talking about your own condition, essentially, by doing so. Now, those graffitis have now been taken down, right? Those signs also, because people caught on after a while. But in India, like, there are things that people are talking about. Students are pushing back, right? Of course, there's an incentive, again, if you are in the sciences, you know, if you are in tech, for instance, that if you want, you have to close your eyes and try to get a job, right? You're going to get a job at all these big media companies or big tech companies that are all getting, like, finances from Israel or from the U.S. Like, Israel has a huge investment thing into AI and cybersecurity and startups in India. And so if you are in tech and you're in the sciences, you're being lured into it, right? But if you're in humanities, there's a lot more space for people to be, like, trying to imagine different worlds, essentially. But yes, there are a lot of groups that are doing things. It's not, like, stagnant or anything. People are pushing, people are trying, but people are very scared. And people, they are concerned they can be picked up at any moment, essentially. So there's a lot of times where I'm talking to someone and we're discussing something, and then that person stops talking. They just disappear, right? And it's like, because they don't know if their phones are being surveilled and all of that. So it's really, like, become, that's kind of scary, essentially.
How do you go about seeing the stories or grappling with the stories of students? And how do you represent that in international media, standing against this larger force that is Hindutva?
That's an interesting question. Sometimes they find me. They reach out on social media, on Instagram especially, to ask a question. They ask for the PDF. So we have a discussion. I do some research on them. And they got to sort of prove that they're not a spy being sent. And then we talk, basically. And I have a newsletter. Basically, I try to get these new voices to write about their experiences. So there was one piece that came out recently. It was a Palestinian student living in India, like what it's like to be a Palestinian at the moment in Delhi. Like, it's horrific, you know? Like, you're working and living in a university that talks about, like, you being a liberal university, and suddenly everyone has abandoned you, right? Because you're Palestinian, right? So that's one. Then there's a piece coming out, inshallah, maybe tomorrow, next week, about Chhattisgarh, right? There's a huge, we don't talk about that, right? There's a huge operation going on against the people in Chhattisgarh, you know, the indigenous people there, right? And thousands of troops going in. As everyone's talking about India and Pakistan, they're, like, bombing the hell out of these people, right? And so there's a piece coming from the ground regarding that. Essentially, like, in that case, someone, a Kashmiri, reached out to me to talk about what's happening in Bastar, basically. And so like, there's, like, weird connections going on, right, between these groups that are all, like, being oppressed, you know? There'll be someone in the US who's Dalit, who's connecting with someone in, like an Adivasi activist in Chhattisgarh, who's connected to someone in Kashmir, and they pass, they pass the details, and they're looking for people to tell these stories. Now, the challenge is that we don't use their names, because then they're going to be screwed, basically, right? But yeah, now the difficulty is that the Western press are so outside the loop on so much of the stuff, and journalism is also under attack to such an extent. It's like dead in many ways, in which there's no time to be sitting with someone and talking and developing relationship. It's like you move from one story to the next story, you know. So there's a lot of dilemmas regarding these things, but that's sort of the process.
First of all, thank you so much for your discussion and talk. It was really enlightening. There was a lot of rhetoric of complicity and colonialism and expansion in your talk. Based on these elements, I was wondering, could the Indian government's realist state-building efforts and securitization under Hindu nationalism be seen as a turn to totalitarian state-building? Is this a way for India to use hard power, such as conflict with Pakistan, alliances with Israel, and the annexation of Kashmir, to mobilize its population and consolidate an illiberal democracy?
It's barely a democracy, and there's barely democracies anywhere, right? U.S. is not a democracy either. So, yeah, that has already begun, and you could say certain states are more so than others. Like certain places, UP, Haryana, these places are a lot more illiberal, if you want to call it. They're like, in a way, you can call India, like Israel is like an ethnocracy, right? It's basically just an ethnicity-driven type of place, like where one ethnic group benefits more than the other, right? I mean, it's exactly that, where you are creating a country where there's a difference between citizenship and nation. So if you are part of the nation, so you're Palestinian and you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, you're not part of the Jewish nation, right? So if you're Muslim in India, you know, you're moving towards that. In many ways, in some states, it's already like that, where you are a citizen, but you're not part of the Hindu nation. So, which means that either you've got to prove yourself continuously, like become the colonel that goes to war for India, right? So as you say, like you have to, in that way, or you have to become subservient to the state continuously, and you have to hide your Muslimness or hide your difference, essentially. So yes, so that's already been mobilized. In fact, the people are doing that in many ways. The state is not coming up with a policy that says, go and hack this person or lynch this person. The state doesn't say that, right? But it's encouraging people to do so in different ways. So you have people walking through neighborhoods in certain parts where there'll be screaming genocidal chants about the people living there, the Muslims living there. The Muslims will end up throwing stones at those guys. So then they are picked up and taken to jail, basically, right? And then if the proof comes out that they were provoked into doing these kinds of things, there'll be no apology from the state, essentially, because that's going to cost them politically, right? So it's, again, it goes, so yeah, that has already happened. It's just that because India is so big, it's not happening everywhere all the time, right? And I think we have to be clear about that. But yeah, it's, for me, it's already that illiberal, and it's an ethnocracy to me, essentially.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance. He spoke in Vancouver, British Columbia. Azad Issa is an award-winning journalist and a senior reporter for Middle East Eye. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Amy Goodman, Claudia de la Cruz, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, Tariq Ali, and Vijay Prashad. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance, and for Vijay Prashad's book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, just call us 1-800 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sansad in Vancouver, B.C. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar maestro Vilayat Khan, Raga Mian Kitori.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. It's Burnaby. Bum, 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 bum.
This is Bird Note. I'm J. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist, naturalist, and writer. And this is a note I've written to a bird I love. Dear Wood Pee-wee, thanks so much for bringing a bit of mystery to my backyard. There's something so tropical about having you in my little South Carolina acreage. It's not that Phoebe and Great Crested Flycatcher don't excite me. They do. But something about your sallying, your little leaps off the branch to nab a fly, just make you different. Okay, being totally honest, there's been a time or two when you perched high up on top of the neighbor's dying maple snag, and I thought you might be an olive-sided flycatcher. But you turned into better light, and your vest wasn't quite right. To top it off, you let a bit of your late summer song slip out. Pia! So understatedly simple and definitive, it's kind of easy when you say your name like that. So anyway, hope you found my little pseudo-pine savanna satisfactory. I know you dig that kind of park-like setup, so be careful, Pee-wee. Travel safely back south. Hope to hear you here next year. Catch you, but not flies, later. Drew.
This is your wake-up call.
But I didn't request
liver disease affects 1 in 4 Canadians.
It doesn't come with a warning. It doesn't wait for the right moment. It can happen to anyone at any time. While liver disease may be part of your story, it doesn't define it. Liver Canada is here for you before, during, and after diagnosis. Find resources, support, and hope at liver.ca. Liver Canada, by your side at every stage.